necessity of calling this and sort of this.
What about me?
Port number, HTTP is needed. These are other things with different port numbers. And allow this thing to be connected to the server successfully. Now I might do another thing. You have to know how to edit HTML, so do a webcast, so you know, I'm gonna do that then. Make it more short. Or is it that much longer experience learning how to webcast? And it's so WWE. A zero and a focus versus only a focus.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
That's annoying.
Yes.
Huh.
Well, two projectors are not the same. You'll figure the industrial organization of the United States has produced two distinct items.
How is that possible? No, my number is that we aren't using the one with both. That would be here.
Correct.
And so that you wouldn't actually have to physically pick the stuff up and move it to change what it is. Which I just watched again.
Yep. I'm just going to move it on. Right, so now the webcast is up. You can people go to the property URL and it will play a separate site with my front screen with us talking. Well, if you're out there listening, the answer is that the webcast is about to start, and the cable just doesn't quite plug in yet.
But it's happening.
Yes. Okay, So it's going to be my input?
Yeah.
I can put it into a...
So let's get started. Let's get started. Am I on? Let's get started.
Well, how do I get my volume up? Yeah, let's pause this thing. Is my volume?
Hello? Hello?
Come on.
So, welcome. We have a very busy agenda today, so we might as well get started. One quick announcement to start with. The Internet and Society Moot Court is set and ready to go. We have judges. We have more judges than you can shake a stick at. Six of them, to be sure. I'd love attendance to outnumber the number of judges and litigants, so please plan on attending. For MIT students, I believe this is required. I don't know why I'm the heavy that has to tell you this, but I'm the heavy. You have to come to the moot court. For INS 99 students, I beg and plead for you to come to the moot court, which is the evening of December 1st, 1999, from 7 p.m. till probably 9 p.m. or so. And I promise a good time will be had by all. So with that, why don't we just jump right into class? Is there anything else I'm missing, Kyle? Okay.
So we left off. So, talking a little bit about Marshby, Alabama, and the boundary between the public and the private.
And that's a big part of what we're going to explore today. We're incredibly fortunate to have a lot of help to explore it, not only up here, but distributed throughout the room. I want to start, actually, by asking for a self-introduction from Mr. Paul Vixie, who came all the way from Silicon Valley, or is it L.A., to be here.
I live in San Francisco.
San Francisco.
So, I am the creator of the Real-Time Black Hole List, which is the thing that you might have heard about in your reading for this. It's not my day job, but that's why you know who I am.
So how did you get this idea?
For the Black Hole List?
Right.
Started with the Bandwidth Partner Program for Cyber Promotions.
What was the Bandwidth Partner Program for Cyber Promotions?
Sanford Wallace had a lot of his ISP accounts yanked because he was spamming, and he decided that the way to solve this problem was to come up with cheap PCs, give them away to people, in fact, pay them for hosting, or give them a free T1 if they would host it, and various ways to do that, and bounce all of his mail through other people's ISPs, where it was the ISP itself who was doing the hosting and thus was unlikely to lose their connectivity over sending the spam. So he was trying to organize a system of relays that were, by their nature, unblockable.
And these were called Bandwidth Partners?
Yes. Cyber Promotion Bandwidth Partners.
So what did you do?
I took it as a challenge to find a way to block them in spite of their nature. So I blocked them on my own systems, let the NANOG community, who is a operational ISP community, know that I had done that, and about three-quarters of them, and there were maybe, let's say there were 80 members at that time, so around 50 or 60 of them said, gee, sounds like a good deal, could you please send me that list, but I don't want to get the spam here either, and that was the genesis of the program.
So what are your machines again? You say you block them on your own machines, you've got a home computer, you've got other machines you use in this
room? Yeah, it's a collection of guests and guest host domains and a couple of different local nonprofits, my own consulting practice. In the years since then, it has grown up into a full-fledged ISP, but at that time, it was just a collection of machines. No one would have been hurt by being unable to reach me. The amount of spam that could not be delivered or the amount of valuable internet resource that couldn't be reached because I refused traffic was small. So it was only because of the subscriber base to my list that the list gained power.
And tell us just a little bit more about NANOG. What does NANOG stand for?
It's the North American Network Operators Group, and it is just a bunch of ISPs, and they are in fact not from North America. It's a worldwide thing. But it grew out of the NSFNet regional techs medium. And so if you're a beeper carrying geek for UNIONet, that's where you go to talk to the beeper carrying geeks from Sprint about how to do the next generation technology for the internet.
So NANOG occasionally has meetings in real space. You get together, you talk about things.
Three times a year.
Is it open membership? Can anybody join NANOG?
There is no such thing as a member. You have to pay to come to the meetings because somebody has to pay for the room and the food and whatnot, but there's no such thing as a membership card or membership number or anything like that. You just go or you don't go.
No kings, no presidents, no voting.
Definitely not. Even less so than at the IETF.
And is it valid? And if I wanted to go to an NANOG meeting, then I pay my money, I drink my coffee, there I am.
And there you are.
The asking for the fee for those is marketing.
Yeah, it's also gotten to the point where there are too many people who want to come, and usually the rooms and facilities are of a fixed size. Deliberately so, but there's no cause to advertise.
Gotcha. I'm just imagining people, you know, camped around the corner in a line at 5 a.m. the night before to get into the Manog meeting. That doesn't happen.
No, they camp up. Yeah, they camp out the night before the meeting. There's never really a rush for the first 500 people or whatever the cap is going to be for a given list. But those people don't have any problem signing up. It takes usually, you know, 3 or 4 weeks for that to fill, but then it does always close.
Gotcha. People within or groups within Manog, and before you know it, you've got sort of a collective. I don't know what you'd call it.
It's an organized boycott.
An organized boycott.
Push a button, you get action at a distance.
And did you maintain this personally? So you would simply do your own sleuthing, figure out who had become a bandwidth partner of Sanford Wallace, and once you found that out, you add them to your list.
I would wait to get spammed from a new bandwidth partner and add them to the list, yes.
That would be kind of basically good evidence that...
I never went looking, and we still don't ever go looking. That's a strong policy, and it differentiates us from some of the other blocking lists on the Internet, is that we always have to have spam in hand before we can begin sleuthing.
Does that include what perhaps the lawyers among us would call hearsay spam, where I could send you spam and say, look what I got, and on the basis of that, you might add somebody to the list?
That has happened a time or two, and it is it's one of the things we're looking for as sleuths, if we see that there's anything fishy about the spam. So what's happened a time or two is that someone wants to discredit a competitor, and they just say, well, look, I got spammed from thus or so server, hoping that that person will get put on my list so that they'll look bad to their own customers. But that's pretty difficult to forge spam at that level.
So how many new entries are made to your list every day these days?
Of course, they come in bunches, and there's a complicated process where there's the sort of the complaint, then there's the sleuthing, then there's the nomination, then there's the verification, and then finally the approval. So I would say I approve maybe 80 a week now.
And do people get off the list? This isn't the Hotel California kind of thing? I mean,
in any given week, about half that number are removed, and it is much easier to get off than to get on. It doesn't require any approval by me, for example, to get off the list. If you can convince one of the various volunteer maintainers that you have cleaned up your problem, and it's usually very easy to verify that you've cleaned up your spam problem, then they can submit a removal request, and those are automated.
How many volunteers do you have working?
I have 5 volunteers and 3 full-time employees.
3 full-time employees?
Yeah.
And who pays their salary?
The salary, boy, the budget right now comes from a combination of grant money from companies who think this is good work and should be done, from myself and Dave Rand, who is the other founder, and we have a couple of revenue programs that we're putting in place now to try to sell a commercially advantageous version of this list. It's only different because of its performance, and so the only people who would need to pay are the ones who are moving a lot of mail.
So nobody gets on to your list without your personal say-so?
Or Dave Rand. It has to be a board member of the nonprofit.
Oh, so then there is a formal, then, nonprofit that now administers this. The MAPS, perhaps that's the Mail Abuse Prevention System.
LLC, yeah.
LLC. Gotcha. Dave, host. Sure, absolutely. And you should introduce yourself, too, as long as you're... There's another mic here, too.
I'm David Post. I teach at Temple Law School. I've written a little bit about this issue. What I want to know before I give you my thoughts is, well, what your definition of spam is what? When you say we're using the word as if it is obvious, and I gather that it sort of is obvious to you what is or is not spam. I'm curious how you would define it.
It is obvious now, but I recognize that there are some fine points in the definition. Well, it has not always been obvious. There are people who define spam to be unsolicited commercial email. I don't believe it has to be commercial in order to be considered spam. Sometimes it is unsolicited bulk email, UBB, as has been used. And that comes closer to the target for me, but unsolicited robotic or unsolicited automated mail is perhaps the best definition to put the very finest point on it. And the reason for the name of our company being what it is that it is mail abuse. This is, we are the mail abuse prevention system. And so spam is loosely defined as mail abuse and specifically defined as unsolicited automated email.
I just want to make sure we see what kind of taxonomy of systems there are out there. Somewhere in this directory, we have a copy, orbs.doc. I think that's it. One fine morning at 5 a.m. at the Berkman Center, in mid-September, I was sent the following email. And it said, please read this entire message carefully before replying, et cetera, et cetera. 140.247.216.239, that is cyber.law.harvard.edu, has been detected as an insecure email relay and added to the ORBS database. Please check the ORBS website for links to other sites that may be able to help you close your relay. To remove from the ORBS database, you need to disable the external relay features of your mail server and then report the IP address to our website at this thing. We will immediately remove your site's entry, then retest it for third-party relay top capabilities. Now, compare RBL to ORBS.
This is itself automated. There is no human in the loop. There was a spam trap address somewhere, and it received mail, and it tested the prior hop, the mail server from which it received the mail, to see if it would relay other mail. And if that was true, it was automatically submitted to the robot who sent you this message. So there was no human in that loop, and there was no prior notification at all. You don't get mail saying, by the way, I'm getting spam from you. My robot tells me that you're mailer is unsecure and is willing to relay for third-party spammers. Please close it. If you don't close it within some period of time, I'm probably going to start refusing traffic and recommending that others do likewise. That's what I just said is more similar to what we do.
This is called zero strikes and you're out.
Pretty much.
And Ben, what was your reaction when you were the postmaster that caught this? What was your reaction, as you recall? Which did you do? That's the right answer. Very good, Ben. I'm very pleased with that. I felt a sort of sense of panic, perhaps a sinking of one's heart, realizing that perhaps thanks to ORBS, which uses a similar boycotting scheme, is that right? People can subscribe to ORBS who run networks and have downstream customers, just like they can subscribe to your list. In fact, they can subscribe to both.
Many people do subscribe to both. ORBS was, technologically speaking, a clone of our list. So when we were creating the initial real-time black hole list, there were no facilities to subscribe with. There was nothing you could do to go tell SendMail or any other mail program, please subscribe to this blocking list, please verify incoming mail against this, please use the following protocol to do so. But we caused all of that infrastructure to be built, and then these folks came along and said, gee, that infrastructure is good, the protocol is good, but fall is not draconian enough, so we want to do this in a slightly different way.
How interesting. So you're saying before it was a human-intensive effort as a network service provider to connect with you and make use of your list. You then build an architecture so that I could just somehow tweak my mail receiving program for a site and say, by the way, I don't want any mail that this particular list out there doesn't approve. It's kind of like PIX, the platform for internet content selection, but not with websites, with mail sites. and not for content, but for some third party saying, ignore this site.
Yes.
And do you get along well with the Orbs people?
No.
Interesting. Jeff Schiller, you're here. I understand there's a story to be told. Maybe we're starting to run out of microphones. I'd love to hear. Tell us your story.
Well, which one might that be? Okay, yes. I'm Jeff Schiller. For those who don't know who I am, I'm MIT's network manager. And I, too, have gotten mail that looks like that from the Orbs people. And our main mail hubs are still blocked by the Orbs people, because what they need us to do, we cannot do. We cannot do for two different reasons. One of the things we cannot do is, what Orbs is doing these days is they're testing by actually sending a forged piece of mail. So when they contact us to try to relay through us, they actually put a from field on that indicates this is somebody at MIT trying to send this message. And then they send it to themselves and see if they get it.
Otherwise, you could imagine an open relay closing itself only to test messages from Orbs in order to hide the fact that it's open.
Well, we tried that in a fit of tick. And what we got for our efforts is we're now on their static black hole list.
And what's the static black hole list?
Meaning they figured it out and they have blacklisted us, and we cannot go to their website and automatically get unblocked, but instead have to send them email and beg and, you know, plead and be on our hands and knees or something, maybe they'll unblock us.
And how much mail from MIT doesn't get delivered to the world at large as a result of being on the Orbs list?
Not much, actually. We go through this habit where, now, I must say that this is one of these cases where being MIT helps, which is good for us, but what it says is that there's justice for the mighty. When we get blocked by, say, a large corporation, several of which have done this because they use Orbs, and I won't name them, and we find this out, we contact them, and we say, you're blocking us. And they say, well, we're using Orbs, and if they're blocking you, so be it. And we say, well, yes, we're blacklisted by Orbs, and frankly, there's nothing we can do about it. Because I didn't finish my story. The second part of the reason we can't block now is Orbs is being clever, and they will try to send a message to a machine on your campus, and if that machine forwards it to your mail relay that then forwards it out, they block you. So if any one of the 80,000 machines on my campus, which is relaying mail through my main mail hubs, is itself open, then they block my main mail hubs. The likelihood that I could get all of those machines, even if it was only 10% of them that were in the state, simultaneously cleaned up is next to zero. And of course, the next day there'll be another machine unpacked out of the box and in this state. And from what I can tell, people are regularly scanning our addresses trying to do this.
Of course, fair enough. It sounds then like if you are Orbs and you're wanting to stop open relays from happening, which is relays that accept mail from anybody without having to worry about where they come from, it sounds like this is the way you have to do it. If they were to allow you to accept mail from anybody at MIT, and in turn that could be an open relay, it wouldn't be a very effective filter, right?
Yes. Well, let me just go back to the thing. Because we're MIT, when we do get blocked, we contact a company and we wind up on a whitelist. Because these companies make the decision that they're not willing to block mail from colleagues at MIT.
And they can do that while remaining subscribed to Orbs.
Some of them have figured out how to do that.
So you say, I want to deny mail from anybody that Orbs lists except MIT. They get through no matter what.
Yes. Yes.
And have you ever had a run-in with the real-time black hole list?
Yes, I did.
How did that unfold?
We discovered we were blocked.
You weren't notified?
No.
Is that a glitch call, or was that, is this normal procedure? I see.
A question of fact.
Well put.
And we don't have to pursue that one. But when I tried to contact somebody, and I forget who I talked to, it wasn't Paul. I got someone whose attitude was sort of like, well, schoolboy, who the heck do you think you are being a spam relay? Don't you know you're evil? And when I try to explain that
do you know who you're talking to?
No, actually, I didn't do that. I sort of said that, you know, the way we operate kind of precludes us from doing the obvious dumping. We actually do have anti-spam tactics in place at MIT. But the typical orbs, the single test message, I'll forward a single piece of email and see if it gets through, that is not the signature of spam, because a spammer never sends but one message. Spammers send lots of messages. So the way we do spam blocking is a couple will get through before we realize it. And we have some automated stuff, and then we have some cases where we do stuff manually after we look at logs. But we are not, you know, saying, hey, we want our right to relay spam per se, but we want the right to use technical measures that are a little bit more sophisticated than the dumb block everything and deny service to your users.
But it would be hard for orbs to automatically test that thing without having to really try to send spam, because they'd have to try to send a ton of emails, right?
That's right. That's right. There's no good way that they've come up with to do that test.
Gotcha. So what happened with the RBL?
Well, after a little bit of heated exchange, where I said we can't really abide by this, and they said, well, too bad, you'll just be blocked. Eventually, I think Paul interceded, and I guess Paul knew who I was, and cooler heads reigned, and we were removed from the list.
And again, is this a board vote procedure? Could there actually be a split vote on the MAPS board about an instance like this, or you can trump and say this goes off the list? And how about getting on? Can any board member say this? I guess you can't have that be consistent, can you? And how big is the board again?
The person he talked to on the phone doesn't do phone work anymore. And he likes it better that way. He's a technologist by trade, and so everyone in the world is happier that he's not on the phones. So the thing that Jeff is doing is sufficient to stop spam. But it took a couple of exchanges before I understood what it was. And for that matter, I think that we were responsible for some improvement to Jeff's basic technology. And, so everybody got a little smarter and a little bit better during this process. The thing is, since there is a human in our loop, we can make exceptions. We can make judgment calls, and we can say, yeah, but it's Jeff. And he's not going to be a fully wide open spammer, and yeah, he relays tests, but he spammers don't like him very well because he does stop them. So he's got other measures in place that cause spammers to not use him very often. We don't need to worry about Jeff. We're taking him off the list. And the Orbs folks don't have that because they're too automated, and they don't have that because they don't have the judgment, even if humans do get involved. The temptation has been there. Certainly there are a number of complete wackos out on the map. I've been very active in DNS politics, and I've made a number of sort of anti-friends in that arena. And it's been very tempting to just say, all right, I would like to view the internet without you in it, so I'm going to. But no, we do not do that. And there's a gray area here, which is spam support services. So if all you're doing is running a web page, and on that web page you are advertising spam software, and buy our software, it'll help you scrape 2 million addresses per hour, it'll help you cloak your identity, it'll help fool all these spam, it'll fool Jeff, whatever.
we will black hole that site even though we're not being abused by it. That's right. It will not be preemptive. We will work with them. We'll try and get the web hosting operator to basically fire their customer. And if they assert their constitutional right to host any content they want, then we assert our constitutional right to deny their passage on our networks. And wait, one other quick thing. There have been a couple of folks who they treat this as a game. They get the mail. They don't like our politics. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. We block them. And rather than live under the block, they switch ISPs, they switch addresses within address blocks, they do all sorts of things.
They don't do that.
And so we've got three different companies right now where we do track them, where every week somebody will find out, okay, what new resources have they brought on the net, and block them all, just systematically.
So that means a certain person, some of them on product, universe, family, people. After those
strikes are exhausted,
no matter where that person comes out, the camera comes down, you get the interface on that spot.
That's correct. Jeff, I wouldn't venture a guess, but I would say a lot more than Orbs. It's a lot more popular a list. And there are ISPs that actually use the RBL to block IP packets so that not only can you not get email to somebody, but you can't get anything to that person if they're on that list.
So if my machine, my office, the train stop off, the carbon dot in, and then you can block it, you can block it. Sending spam making material from the net, instructions from the spam, and get black hole, it might be possible
subscribers
to black hole would actually make it so that I'm looking
to go to the website and my very packets are clipped
going to
the black hole.
That's correct. Professor, you were talking about the whitelist before.
Mm-hmm.
You call up Corporation X saying from MIT, you know, we're on this we're not getting mail through because I've been put on the ORC list. Has anyone ever said that rather than tweaking their list to put MIT back on, has anyone ever said gotten off of Orbs because of that?
Well, actually, there's two categories of people that fit this. There's those who all we have to do is subscribe them to Orbs, because it turns out they're just as open as we are.
Uh-huh.
And there's a realization that dawns.
Yes, okay.
Yes, the pot kettle category. And yes, there are others where we don't have to do that, where they are shocked to discover that they would have blocked us. They had thought when they had subscribed to Orbs that the only people who would be blocked would be the spammers, because after all, that's how the service is marketed. Do this and you don't get spam. There's no mention made of, oh, by the way, you may not get certain legitimate email that you desperately want.
Okay. Yeah,
Marlon,
just for a second.
I think we're webcasting to a limited audience right now. So before I ask David to give a brief kind of reaction, a lawyer's, a law professor's, a constitutionalist's reaction to this, I just want to ask Paul, if you were encountering this phenomenon for the first time, if your long-lost twin had invented this instead of you, and as the person you are, beeper carrying techno person, you encountered it, what would your reaction be?
I have to admit that any objective description of this project sounds awful, sounds bad. So people ask me sometimes, so that means that one guy sitting in Redwood City can pretty much bump me off the net and make a third of the net unable to reach me. He's completely unaccountable, and you know, we've got his word as to whether he follows any principles at all, let alone the ones that he publishes. And he's known to be kind of an incendiary personality, and
I don't know how you get that reputation. He seems so nice.
So that's a perfectly objective, valid, truthful description of what's going on here, and it sounds really bad. So I have to admit that I have a lot of sympathy for the first claim that I get from people who find themselves on this list and do a little research and find out what that means.
I heard a butt somewhere about to emerge.
I've been on the net that did not have this facility, and I wish that this facility weren't necessary. At the time that I started on the internet, I knew almost everybody, and they were all pre-selected. They were smart, they were professionals, they were sort of, they knew that if they were rude, they would lose their account through academia or through the military or whatever. They would lose their internet access, and that would be the end. And the moment Netcom came online and started selling $20 a month shell accounts, that they weren't going to turn people off just because they were rude.
There went the neighborhood.
And someday, either the law or the technology is going to catch up to that. But right now, we are, it's the Wild West frontier.
As you say, desperate times call for desperate measures.
So, David, what's your reaction?
I think something really important is going on with the real time black hole. And I wanted to address my sort of remarks here a little bit to the spirit, if not the body, of Larry Lessig. Because of the spirit and all that. But because Lessig and I agree on a lot of things about the net, but not this. Our disagreements about RBL seems to be pretty profound. I happen to think that what Paul is doing is part of the process. It's really quite an extraordinary and quite valuable enterprise, and I recognize it's not. And I've been sort of trying to figure out in preparation to come here to talk to you why that is. The things that Lessig and I agree on about the RBL is that, you've probably heard this before in the class or in some of the meetings, that what Paul is doing has kind of the force of law on the net. That is, it can govern conduct in some way, that on the internet, architectural modifications of this kind are particularly important, significant, regulators of conduct. I buy that. I buy that there are values embedded in the architecture that all the latest values in this case, or those of his organization. But to me, the real-time black hole list, in a sense, is why the net is an exciting place, and an exciting place normatively, and for thinking about governance processes. That this is a process for solving a problem that has a lot of attractive features, but not too less. In the piece that I think was on the standard, he asked, is this the way to make network policy, which the answer is obviously not. It's really quite transparently clear, sort of beyond question, that there's something wrong is allowing this to take place. And I honestly cannot figure out what the objection is. And I think it's worth thinking a little bit. I wish I could hear. Maybe you could plan. It's the obvious that troubles you. It's that one word. Obviously, this is the wrong way. This is not how we should make network policy. I think Lessig thinks that there should be network policy. Some about spam. He's playing those about spam. He's participated in working groups to try to craft network policy about spam. I think he believes that it's a real problem. So it must be that he thinks network policy should be made some other way. And I take it that he's thinking of law, right? That there should be a law about spam. That is the way network policy should be made. And I think it's a fair question to ask, why would that be better? What way would, say, a statute? Larry and I actually worked on a working group together to try to help craft a federal statute on spam. And I want to think it is worth asking, what makes that so obviously a better solution to this problem than the process of which Paul is a part? Both? Yeah, you have an answer.
I would rather see that spam was just against the law and that there was a recourse through small claims court or civil court or some other way. I would rather this were not necessary. So I won't join your bandwagon about this being the right way to make network policy. I'm doing I am doing what I'm doing because Congress is a bunch of spineless weasels and somebody has to do this now.
And of course, David, you've only gone partially out on the limb here. So far, I've just heard you say to dismiss Paul's system out of hand without reflection seems hasty.
Well,
but I haven't heard you say you like it.
Well, no, that's correct. At least that's as far as I would like to go here. In a sense, I was Leslie granted a motion to dismiss. Get out of here. This has no redeeming features, it is obvious, and I think there are issues of material fact, as it were, that should preclude summary judgment on this question. I don't know what the right answer to this is, but I think it is very much a deep and difficult question about
the internet. So let me, my Lessig imitation is terrible, both procedurally and substantively, but let me try to do somewhat of a channeling of what his view might be, or at least a view that says, I don't have to reflect for very long before realizing that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Brady's got a nonprofit, a board of a few people. They make their processes, revise them at will. They just impose it on the rest of the net, at least 60% of it. It's fundamentally different to surf the net and send email in a world in which I am blacklisted than in a world in which I am not. And I have no recourse.
Of course, but it's one of
the lawyer. Come on, I mean, where's the law here? Where's the due process?
Well, one of the issues here is that it's imposed on nobody. Imposed is a difficult word to use in this context, it seems to me. There are agents, that is, network administrators at ISPs, who, in a sense, make the votes, and what we call it a kind of voting. They say, do I like Dixie? Do I want to subscribe to Dixie's list? With all that he just said, he's an economist or not, or whatever his personal peculiarities might be. I mean, they make that decision.
So that's a form of accountability.
Well, A, it is a form of accountability, and B, the enforcement mechanism is one of shunning. I think that's a very important difference between what the law would do here and what the real-time black hole does here. All that happens to the students at MIT, let us say, or the students here using this server, if you're on the list, you can, and there are a bunch of ISPs who are subscribers to that list, and they say, we don't want to talk to you. You can go ahead and do what you're doing. We're not imposing any rule upon the MIT server. We're just saying if you behave that way, we don't want to speak to you.
It's not a threat, it's a statement of an action and a consequence.
Well, that's right. The action, exactly, it's a statement of an action and a consequence. And does not rely ultimately on physical force, which I think the congressional statute, of course, would, ultimately. If Congress passed a statute that said such as they have to define spam,
might have
been fine.
Eventually, they'll come after.
Ultimately, their power to make you pay a fine is that they can seize your physical assets and/or your person. This is not that imposing, seems to me.
Jeff Schiller. Yeah, I think you're making a critical mistake.
Okay.
If the RBL was used exclusively by end sites, so if I don't want to get spam, I will not take mail from the people who are identified as spammers or relays. Then I would agree with you. The fact of the matter is, though, that ISPs subscribe to this and impose it upon their customers. And for example, I have a cable modem at home. I have a choice if I want internet access faster than 56 kb of one provider. And if that provider decides to subscribe to the RBL, then they are imposing upon me that view of the world that I didn't ask for.
Yeah, that's a... I disagree with that, Jeff. I I disagree with the notion that you have no choice among ISPs.
You could always use a 33 or 56K connection through CompuServe or something.
If you want to talk about whether the ISP market is monopolized, you can have that conversation. I think that's what you're saying, is that you think that there is a sort of de facto monopoly over ISPs, and therefore you don't really... But this notion that the ISPs impose it on their customers strikes me as sort of wrong. The ISP is your agent. What happens in the legal process? You have an agent in Washington, you have a representative who makes a decision about spam, and then it is imposed upon you. Here you have an ISP who makes a decision about spam, and it is, I would argue, not imposed upon you, because you can say, holy cow, that's terrible, I'm getting another ISP. And I would argue that people are more likely to be responsive, that this market for ISPs is going to work better than the market for spam regulation.
Of course,
is at least an open question sufficient to survive that motion.
Of course, this still presumes a degree of information on the part of the consumer to realize that one of the metrics along which they might choose an ISP isn't just price, it is, does my ISP subscribe to the real-time black hole?
They both assume a degree of information. That is not a way to distinguish two properties. My congressperson, so I don't have one, I live in Washington, that's another story. But your
so bitter about government.
Exactly. Your congressperson, it's a question about how much information they have about the problem and how much the information flows from you as a voter to that person as a representative. It's a parallel problem.
Although, to be sure, very different models. A market model of influence versus
a
political model.
But the same, but it is not enough, it seems to me, to say that in this market model it suffers from sort of an information problem. Of course there's an information problem in markets. An information problem in political markets as well. And I don't know any reason for necessarily saying that the costs are overwhelming in this case on one side or the other.
So let me ask this.
They are spying with reason.
Go out on a limb once again.
Yeah.
I have seen much of your work, and we've interacted, not in the context of the black hole list and spam, but in the context of ICANN. Now, ICANN, we think, at least partially, has been charged with breaking an impasse in administration control, if you will, over the top of the domain name system. And what is the domain name system but merely a domain name system? A series of lists to which people subscribe, ISPs. They could choose another list. There are other routes out there, but by and large they don't. So it's a wildly popular list to which you've come out very much in favor of an accountability model. For instance, we have here Mike Roberts, right? Head of ICANN. And you say, Mike Roberts, I'm not going to trust you with a board of unelected people to make these decisions about the route. How dare you? You need a reconsideration review policy. You need to have a bottom-up participatory political model. I mean, it's not just about markets. So how do you reconcile your view with ICANN and the route with your view with Paul and the black hole?
Well, very easily. The situation with ICANN, what's odd about ICANN,
we talked about ICANN in
the class. Okay. The problem with ICANN is that ICANN is acting as quasi-governmental authority. They are not. I mean, they have been designated by the Department of Commerce to take on this role. They have a kind of...
And what's the force of that designation?
Well, I'm not sure I know what the force of that designation is. And I'm not sure how we will know what the force of that designation is. But it is not correct, it seems to me, to say, ICANN is just like Paul Pitsen. I said when the NSI Department of Commerce agreement ran out, I said, shake hands, walk away. I mean, the contract is done. Let the
Paul Pitsen, if he's interested,
or people like that, go out and form domains and see how the system reconfigures itself. Not the course they took, the course they took with the U.S. government specifically designated a single supplier to run this thing, and if that's the way we're going to do it, sure. I want accountability, because the market is not providing accountability. So I think they're reconciled, but it makes more if they're reconciled.
Mike, I've invoked your name. Do you have anything you want to add at this point?
Well, I've been given a great one-liner to use in the future, and that is that ICANN was created to escape the reach of spineless weasels. Despite the New York Times calling us the new governing body of the Internet, we, in fact, stick pretty close to the two or three items of technical management that we were asked to carry out, and they don't include content. We sort of try aggressively, at the moment at least, to stay out of issues about content. But I'd make a couple of comments about tangential issues that that we're currently involved in. One is that in the NSI agreements, partly due to a lot of pressure from trademark interests and the little cottage industry that has sprung up to support trademark interests looking for infringers, there is a bulk access provision in the contract that requires that network solutions acting as registry must provide bulk access to the files to anyone. They get to charge a fee. They get to charge a $10,000 a year fee for that. But there is an interesting restriction in the contract that the people executing those bulk access agreements with Network Solutions acting as registry can't use it for spamming. So it's probably not going to take long before somebody ends up on Paul's black hole list as a result of an interpretation of what spamming in that context means. So it'll be interesting to watch that development. The second thing that's kind of interesting is that one of the well-known ICANN dissidents using an alias spammed the DNSO open mail list last week with some 60,000 messages, which has created a considerable uproar having to do with sort of the signal to noise ratio and pollution index and the corruption of the commons, and how can you have a democratic process in one of our bottom-up organizations if the dialogue is polluted by people whose only objective appears to be to destroy the ability of people to carry on any rational dialogue on the list. So the Names Council, which has the jurisdiction to figure out what to do about this, is considering measures like, there's an IETF alt list that's maintained in Norway, or if you object to certain people shooting off their mouth on the IETF open list, you can go to that list, and those people are filtered off of it by an authority guy, an authority figure who everyone respects in Norway. The second thing is the network. The Names Council is considering appointing a moderator for the open list. And of course, that immediately gets us right back into free speech issues about, well, why is my speech controlled by a moderator, and what's supposed to be an open, democratic, bottom-up list of ICANN? So that's going to be interesting to watch that evolve.
So I want to work on one more piece of the puzzle before we throw it open both to some of the remote comments and the class at large. The first piece of it is just to acknowledge, David, what I heard you saying then is what makes domain name system management, which we agree is a de facto monopoly of sorts, different from the de facto monopoly that if the real-time black hole list isn't that, it could become that if it becomes popular enough. What makes them different is that this domain name management function had a blessing from the U.S. government that this one doesn't have, even though the form and nature of the blessing, perhaps it created a monopoly or cemented one. But
I did not have to become popular to get this monopoly power. He's popular,
but he did not have to get popular in order to have that power.
Paul does. That sounds sort of good. Isn't that sort of a representative?
But is that right? Because even with the government's blessing, unless the government is forcing people to use the ICANN route, if Mike isn't popular, if the root does something bad, they assign .com to someone else tomorrow,
right,
Mike loses his supporters.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I don't think that ICANN or the DNS system is really a government-imposed monopoly in a strict sense. My fear is, of course, you heard it here first, they'll try to make it one, but that's another story. I think that may happen down the road. But you're right, there are ways to get around it, and that is a concern. But I think there are really fundamental differences in terms of sort of the bottleneck grip on the internet that I can and the DNS represent, as opposed to the full victim.
Before you get off that point, I see that there is that distinction. There's no way for anyone to avoid ICANN.
Right.
Anyone who wants to avoid me, they can avoid me easily.
Right.
But there is another key distinction, which is that I am the primary maintainer of a software system called Bind, which implements DNS in the open source way. And it probably, even in the face of stiff competition from Microsoft, probably still serves 95% of the DNS data on the internet. So with that, I will make the following simple assertion from authority, which is that there really can only be one there can only be one mic.
Right.
It was either going to be NSI, it was going to be Mike, it was going to be somebody. Until we modify the protocols extensively, there does have to be a single authority in the arena that Mike is playing in. There does not have to be any authority, let alone a single authority, in the arena I'm playing in.
I completely agree with that. That is the important thing. That's why I'm concerned with a board of review for ICANN, and representation, and lots of other models, because there will only be one. And I'm not concerned about that. As far as I'm concerned, Paul Dixie can go home and flip a coin to decide who gets on this list, because I think over time, as I asked about the white list, people are not going to buy into that list. Why would they if Paul Dixie is just flipping a coin to decide who's on it? Let me just say, the last thing I will say, just in terms of an affirmative case, I'm so amazed to be here to try to persuade Paul Dixie that what he's doing is a good thing, and it's in sort of preferable to alternative models. It seems to me there are a couple of affirmative things that his system has that the alternative model does not. I think that ISPs generally are better agents with respect to consumer individual views about spam than congressmen. That's one. I think the agents in this system, the ISPs, are not geographically defined. I think it's a very important new part of this system, is that these are representatives, but they're not defined arbitrarily by some geographical thing that means nothing on the internet. They are defined electronically. Mentioned the point about shunning, that I think is a less coercive enforcement tool. And fourth is, I think he's less susceptible to capture. Significantly, not Paul is not. Paul may be completely susceptible to capture. Microsoft may come in tomorrow and pay him off, for all I know. But the process in which he's part, I think, is apparently less susceptible to capture than the author.
Even though it clearly has possible transparency problems. If you get listed, you may not even know it. Others certainly may not know it. And unless Jeff can assert power from MIT or somebody can rally Wired News, it does leave. I mean, if you were to slip a few of those people you just detest, or anti-like, I think was your word, onto your list, do you think anybody would cease subscribing to it as a result? They wouldn't even know.
They would find out. I have watchdogs. They would look for that. They would trumpet it from the rooftops. Look what Paul did now.
Exactly. I don't know why. I mean, again, transparency is an important value in the system. I need to be persuaded that Congress is more transparent in some way than this process of which you talk. It may be true. We can have that discussion.
Then the political machinery of a modern democracy is more transparent and efficient than a guy.
Then the process of which he is a part, that's right. That information about what he is doing, he has to solicit customers as a subscriber, that is going to be necessarily less transparent than some deal made down in Washington where Bell Atlantic and Microsoft didn't really decide what it was. I don't know.
Let me fill in an important missing part of the story. When I first started the list, there was no LLC. There was no board of directors. It was just me. And there was no particular plan for what I was going to do when it succeeded. There was anger. There was the desire to stop one bad person from doing one bad thing.
and it was a completely unscalable design. It wasn't even a design. I started taking on volunteers because I had hundreds of complaints. Please list this site because they're bad. I had no time to follow up on the number of complaints people were sending me, but there was a huge demand for the service, and that is what caused me to start doing the volunteers and eventually work out some grant funding, get a corporation, all the rest of it. But the original plan was not to succeed. The whole original desire here was to get sued. I thought that within 3 months of starting that list, I would be shut down under a TRO, and there would be a lawsuit, and somebody would say that I had violated the Sherman Act, or they'd find something to stop me with, and that we would then begin the dance through the courts and end up with a decision, hopefully in my favor, that would have the force of a law that these spineless weasels in Washington, D.C. cannot make because they owe the DNA too much money. And that lawsuit never materialized, which means that spammers are also spineless weasels. And that is why I had to make an organization.
Do you have a separate spineless weasels list?
That's why I had to make the organization. That's why I had to get the funding. That's why we have a board of directors, is because of the primary objective of getting sued. I no longer think I can pull that off.
So another good Berkman Center clinical project, you know, for fun and scholarly interest would be to sue to be able to. But,
go for it.
Now, what little we do have by way of lawsuit, was brought by Gary Reback. Because anytime he has a chance to sue Microsoft, he appears to relish the challenge, suing Microsoft on behalf of Blue Mountain Arts. Now, by your reckoning, if I go to a site that allows me to enter a list of names in and then push send and a greeting card with little animations that I have selected list is then hitting every mailbox of the people I've listed, is that spam?
Can be, and what it depends on is whether you yourself have to be registered as a user. When Blue Mountain was putting their plan together, they worked very hard to make it impossible for people to anonymously send those greeting cards, to anonymously cause a mail exploder effect to happen inside the Blue Mountain system. You have to register, you have to have an email address which works. And then you can start using their system to send these electronic.
But if I'm a spammer, then I just get a Hotmail account. That Hotmail account works. See, I get the mail in, I send the mail out, I go to Blue Mountain, and I send greetings. How would you like to buy my stuff as a card? Isn't that spam?
That would be, but Blue Mountain keeps that from happening.
Really?
Yeah. There are other greeting card sites. For example, the one on Amazon.com that doesn't do that.
Are they on your list?
They were threatened with it, and they are working on it. They made promises that I can't repeat here that kept them off the list. But on the Amazon.com greeting card equivalent that they were trying to use to compete with Blue Mountain, you could send a greeting card which would come from anybody you said it was coming from. And so I, as the way I found out about this is that some third party forged mail coming from the executive director of Maps to me that was an Amazon.com greeting card. And the text of the greeting card was, there's no way you can find out who really sent this.
With a dancing turtle.
With a dancing turtle. And so, you know, they got me that time. So Blue Mountain does a much better job than Amazon.
And in this case, does it bother either of you that Microsoft Outlook, a mail client distributed free with Windows, at least Outlook Lite or whatever it's called, has built-in filters that default to on, such that Blue Mountain greeting cards get stuffed into the trash as quickly as they arrive?
Yes, that does bother me.
What's the difference? That and the RBL. Isn't Microsoft just making the decision and I don't have to use Outlook if I don't like the way it behaves?
I mean, I think the difference is that, you know, lawsuits and warnings will recognize that death is different, you know, the argument is the death penalty was too generous. Microsoft is too generous because of its control over the platform and the operating system. I think it is not I think we have to separate out. We make no progress if we say because there's some principle applicable to Microsoft which controls, and, you know, we all know what it controls. We've all read the findings of fact, et cetera. Their conduct troubles me more than
so if Microsoft created the,
if
they created the MBL, the Microsoft Black Hole List, people could subscribe.
And if they embedded it into their browser, I'd be concerned about that. If they created the MBL and allowed people to subscribe the way Paul does, I have no problem. Invite them to do that. That means there should be competitors to what he does. Could be other kinds of lists with other definitions of spam. And we'll see what people think spam is. I mean, one of the things about the definitions is not so easy to define spam. And different people will view it differently. And one of the ways we will uncover the definition of spam is to see how successful the maps and the orgs and the Microsoft, et cetera, are.
Okay, so in the world in which the RBL becomes wildly popular, or ISPs have a shakeout in the industry and it converges, so there are three ISPs, AT&T, Media One goes into AT&T, Bell Atlantic goes into Media One. I see you have two ISPs, and each of them subscribes to the RBL, thereby bringing the RBL perhaps to other lists. 100% of the subscribers in a vast geographic swath. Are you worried then? Is there any new that? Then you're worried.
I mean, there are 14,000 ISPs in the United States, but if you want a positive world in which there are two, and you say, is that different? It wasn't different. That's an immense difference.
You don't need reflection for that. It's just...
Well, I don't need that much reflection for that, but that is not the world we live in. We could argue probably self-class about whether that is the world we live in. I happen not to believe that, but I understand that. But it's surely not the world we live in now.
Gotcha. Why don't we open it up? I think there are online comments and surely ones around here, too. Somebody with a spam shirt on, too, that might have a view. So, comments. Bob. Behind me, Lance Rowland from the Washington State RCW, who is in the room. Welcome, Lance. I receive about 300 pieces of solicited legitimate email per day with only about 2 pieces of unsolicited email, otherwise known as UCDM, per day. This ratio is after publicly listing my address as being a resident of the state of Washington, along with about 1 warning letter every couple of months to spammers about the legal and financial risks of sending spam at Washington. I love the sound effects of the quitting email spam to Washington junk spec. This puts the burden and expense back in the hands of the spammers. Discuss the law and ways of integrating RBH's real-time black hole list technology into the process. Any reaction?
We have a federal anti-junk fax statute, and its claims are all based on the cost of fax paper. In fact, there is a resource which is consumed by sending fax, even though there's a local phone call and so forth. And also, you can't use the line for something else at the same time a junk fax is coming in. Those arguments are trivially extensible into the realm of email. If you consider the cost of a full mailbox that is, you know, 98% spam, you can't find your real mail, you can't use it for other things at the same time. If we have something at federal level that did for junk mail, junk email, what we have that does for junk fax, I believe the spam problem would be gone worldwide.
Very, very interesting. I think I disagree, that would be a good thing. It is an interesting and a powerful analogy, this junk fax. Fax, I think there is a difference between fax and email. Fax is not an interactive, multi-person medium of communication in the way that email is. Fax has a particular kind of broadcast-like niche. And I think I am less concerned with a statute that places the burden on speakers in that medium. Remember, federal statutes can have to define spam. That is not a trivial problem. It's a very difficult problem. You have to say, maybe it'll take the one that the definition Paul uses, but maybe it won't. There are lots of spam commercials. Does it have to be commercial, for example?
The counter with the version that the Washington law uses.
It could. I think the burden on free speech is significantly greater from that law then the burden on free speech from the jump back law, which is not zero, but I think it's close to zero.
And is there empirical evidence that could convince you that the burden on free speech from Paul's system is more than the burden on free speech from a law passed by Congress? So far, the argument you've made to distinguish them is that ultimately they are guns behind the fines, behind the penalties, behind the lawsuit, behind the law that Congress passes.
And you're asking for what?
Suppose we care that about having free speech take place, even though we have this problem. In fact, it's a problem that you might say runs counter to free speech, because when you have a mailbox full of crap, you can't see the type of mails you care about. And we want to tackle the problem. Could it be that systems like Paul's are ultimately, thanks to the absence of due process protections, the other things we associate with government, or even that we are trying to associate with ICANN, the absence of those make it actually far more threatening to free speech, even though you call it a mere shunning. It's not just shunning. Shunning is, I look at the list and I'll refuse to read the email I'm presented with. This is a much more automated shunning. The email will never, I'll never even know it's there if I subscribe to his list. So the question is, isn't it possibly a much greater stress on free speech this way?
Yes. Isn't it possibly? Yes. I mean, again, my goal in all this is to make somebody think about that question. The answer to that question seems to be very difficult. It's a very tough question. I don't have a simple answer to it, but I don't think you get there by saying that it is obvious, as it were, that one
law is better than
I don't know. It's a very difficult question, and I think you're empirical or theoretical with it.
Yeah, even catch.
Well, why can't we get some numbers about this? I'm just curious, how many institutions are on your list? How many people do you think are affected by the fact that their ISPs or institutions are on their list? I don't understand the technology completely, so I may be making wrong assumptions, but if MIT is on your list, you've got X number of people who have difficulty sending email. Am I wrong about that?
MIT at this point is not on the list.
Are any universities on your list?
Yes, there are 3 universities on the list right now. I cannot show the list because you have all not signed the non-disclosure and liability disclaimer.
What is the non-disclosure liability?
If you have a list of folks that who you think are evil, moral turpitude, whatever, fill out the form. And you pass that amongst people who have asked for it, or who, just they're your buddies. There is no lawsuit for slander, libel, or anything like that, because there's no publication.
How high of your feedback claims against Microsoft is known that Outlook is any real Microsoft is being able to make it without Microsoft.
Yes, so I don't do that. Subscribers all know. They're the ones who need to know.
Can you tell us how many institutions are on your list? How long your list is?
Sure. I think right now we have 1,600 entries varying in size from a single host up to a block of 8,192 hosts. The total number of hosts, host addresses, and addresses which are unreachable, probably numbers in the probably 2 to 3 million, but given that the address space is sparsely allocated, I'd say that no more than 300,000 actual live hosts are affected by what we're doing.
They don't know the whole list, but they would know someone would get a message saying so and so. No, but right?
Yes.
They would know because they would get a message. Somebody would get a message saying your site has been placed on the
object.
No. Once, if you suspect that something might be on the list, you can verify it. That's what your mailer is doing. So if you're interested in knowing for any given IP address, is it on the list or isn't it, you can find out.
You can't find out.
find out.
The whole list.
That's not by domain name, but yes, you can type an IP address. And not only will you find out whether it's on the list, you'll find out why it's on the list. But since there are 4 billion addresses, you can't scan them all.
Right.
Or other listeners. I'll work my way back.
Two remarks. One is, I've heard many references to federal legislation. Oh, I'm sorry, my name's Carl Hoffman. I'm a friend of Jeff's. I came along to watch the fray. I hear many references to Congress and federal legislation, which I personally would welcome, but much of the spam entering my site these days originates outside the United States, and I don't see how that would have much of an effect, especially really the challenge for a spammer is just locating a server.
The anti-junk fax law applies to not only the person who sends it to you, but the product which is advertised. So if the spam comes from China or some other, you know, third world country somewhere, but advertises a product in the U.S., then you would be able to go after the person whose product it is. And that they have the responsibility to prove that they did not hire that spam to be done.
That's a good answer. My second remark was about the concern.
I think that's got to be impossible. This is the first I heard about that, Paul, and I don't think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's never been tested. As I said, that I could be held liable. I have a product, stuff, that I sell, and that you get a junk fax from somebody in China that says buy stuff from David Post, and that I could be liable for that without any proof that I knew this person or had any contact with them. I don't think that's been applied that way, and if it is, I'll take that check.
Well, we have the best part of the response. That went on to at least last time. This is a piece of spam. I get one from Atlanta, Georgia. The mom field is forged. The field is forged. The information relation is forged. There's a note at the bottom of the email that says, this is all forged. Please don't complain to anybody in the field. They have nothing to do with this. Now, order our phone number. The 800 number. And by the way, do not call the 800 number and ask them to be taken off the list. You will not be taken off the list. It will be a waste of time. And here's how it works. Now, if that takes you a defense, that company is
credible. I'm not defending that company.
And the showing that
they're behind. There has to be a showing that they're behind.
If you
can make that showing, I mean, the argument was about the junk fax law, and that that enables you to stop someone. I mean, the more general point was the borders problem, the fact that whatever Congress does is geographically circumscribed in some way, and that, which I agree, and I think that is one of the advantages of this process, is that it has the potential of not being geographically circumscribed. It does not impose those sort of borders on what is otherwise a sort of borderless problem.
Although the print supplier, the toner supplier, could be outside the United States and have a telephone number that is outside of the United States, and you'd still be unable to get your hands on it.
Of course, for physical goods, it's unlikely. I mean, I'm sure they don't get a big response rate anyway, but to think that I, you know, go to China for my print toner, it's got to be electronic goods.
Yeah, but you could go to China for your porn,
right.
And much spam is solicitation for porn services of one kind or another over the Internet. The other remark I wanted to make, though, was Professor Post was talking about whether or not ISPs impose spam filtering on their subscribers, and I think there are relatively easy solutions to that, which are simply opt-in or opt-out to junk mail filtering. I've done work with a company called Mail.com, which is competitive to Hotmail. They manage about 6,000 mailboxes, and at any time a subscriber can indicate whether or not they wish to have their mail filtered for junk mail.
Yeah, exactly, which I think makes the point. That is, you
are responsive if there's concern on the part of consumers. One way the market does work is to reflect that concern. Maybe you'll have to get that.
I work back
on
things that
I just had a quick question, which is, what's the size of the Orbs database?
I don't know. They may say on their webpage how many elements are in it.
Orbs always says we are not collecting any
elements. When they first came up with their project, they called it the Dork Slayers RBL. And there's considerable confusion. In fact, they patterned their initial complaint and their notifications all on text from our system. And so there's a lot of confusion. Gee, why are you blocking us? And we go and check, and of course we're not. Well, why did you think we were? Well, you sent me this. No. No, the other guys, the Dork Slayers guys, sent you that.
And by the way, the Dork Slayers notification
mail. Yes.
Yes,
I have, but I was talked out of it by other people in the project.
Cooler heads again.
I mean, no, we demanded that they stop using the term RBL.
When they also say we're not a black hole, we do not disseminate valid information, not including the host individual.
Well, there are three ways to use blocking technology from maps. One is as an end user. Hotmail now has the ability to select us as one of the filters for their customers. Another is in a mail relay. You can say, I send mail, or I fill in the blank third-party mailer, wish to refuse all mail from any other end, any peer who appears on this list. And the third way is to actually put it right into your routers. And that's what Jeff was talking about earlier. So that is what my erstwhile partner, Dave Rand of AboveNet, does with all of AboveNet. So anyone who buys transit from AboveNet is unable to reach anything that is on the RBL. And I think that he's going too far, but it is his network, and I can't stop him from using it in this way.
Well, it sounds like there is information you
can fail to buy. No. You really have to know what you're doing to want this in your routers, and it's pretty hard to get in and pretty hard to leak and so forth. But in any case, that's what they're referring to. They're saying, we don't offer the BGP feed. You can't use this in your routers. We only do mail.
Can I ask Post two things?
Sure.
First, we talked about market power and ISPs, and I was thinking on the national level, you may not have market power. But if you looked at regional submarkets, maybe a number of places in this country where there's only one or maybe two at most ISPs, does that change your analysis at all?
Yeah, it's true.
I lived in southern New Mexico. Down there, we only had one ISP when I was, well, after I just graduated from high school, we only had one ISP at that time. I think that's still the case. And I think many places like Montana, Wyoming, Idaho are probably like that as well.
You could only reach a single by
a local phone call.
I think, the last I saw, 80-some-odd% of Americans have on average thought it within a local phone call, something like that. Yeah, that changes, I suppose. Does it change my view system-wide? No.
I think that
if that were true for many people, I agree analytically that is a problem.
Right.
I do not believe it is, and I do not believe it's
true. In the short term, the 800 number does solve that problem, but if most people are not going to want to stay on a 56K modem. It's very unreliable and slow. And so with DSL, ISDN, the options narrow again. And as the internet becomes reliant upon higher speed.
Right. I mean, again, this is an important argument. It is a distinct argument about whether, for example, cable modem services monopolize the internet. I think it's not. I think it will spur. We will all be getting high-speed access from lots of different providers, and the telephone companies have their gig, and
lots of other people. But again, separate argument. If you think that the cable companies are going to monopolize service providers, the service provider market, then you have a different, you know, they can agree with everything I say, but still say, we have a problem because of that monopoly. You'd have to persuade me that there is that sort of monopoly or that it is remotely likely to continue, but again, separate discussion.
Can I ask you one more quick question? It seemed like the presumption for civil liability that the advertiser paid for the spam was a pretty clever solution that does fix the problem. And you mentioned something about a constitutional argument. I just don't see it, how a presumption for civil liability would be unconstitutional. If you have it, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, the first I've heard of this, so you really put me on the spot, and I'm a clever law professor. Not sure I'm that clever. It seems odd to me that there's a federal statute that says I can put, let's say, Microsoft, that I can send out a bunch of faxes and put Microsoft's name on the top and subject them to liability unless they can prove that they didn't send it. Something about that
There were discussions, among other things, of creating a right of private action if you receive spam from a spammer. And the fact that so much spam is forgeries means that if you wound up with your name on the front field of a lot of the spam, you know, it was sent to a million people, you probably have 200,000 of them trying to sue you. And I can tell you right now of one case that involved a student at MIT who made the mistake of engaging in a dialogue with a spammer. And as punishment, the spammer sent out all their future spam with this person's return address. And this person received hate mail, death threats, you name it, and eventually had to change their login name and hope. And to this day, they still wonder whether things will blow up when they go home.
But that's just shunning behavior.
No, but I mean, the question is, we can agree that this is, maybe we all agree that this is bad conduct, and we probably agree. The question is, how do you then, what is the process by which it becomes less frequent in the future? That is an open question. I mean, the sheer egregiousness of the conduct does not end the argument about how best to get it under control.
Just referring to something we talked about earlier in this course, we keep referring to digital signatures using encryption. Perhaps the solution to spam is getting everyone to use digital signatures.
Or?
Well, I will say that
interesting.
No one can enter.
Welcome. Charlie Nesson knows how to make an entrance.
No one can enter my house or my car or any of those places without a key. And yet that's a clear sort of small number to one mapping, and it scales very nicely. I make copies of the keys to those various things for the small number of people to whom I want to have access. Digital signatures are only as good as they are managed. So if a spammer needs to have a digital signature in order to send mail, they will make one up. They will just, and there are good random number generators on the market now, you can just sort of make them up. If they have to be registered somewhere, then there's this presumption that I will only accept email from people whose registrations are in my database, which means that there has to be some transitive trust relationship between me and them. That is a huge burden on me compared to the current system by which new people can introduce themselves to me and say, hi, Paul, I've read about the software that you wrote and I have this question about it.
But for example, I could see
even knowing that I don't mind hearing from people I haven't heard from before and wish to through email, at least some, I could see a system whereby I would say I only want to get email from people who have their address verified by some sovereign. Simply the fact that they exist somewhere in real space and they have identified themselves to that sovereign, I don't need to know where they are, but the fact that that verification exists and could be called upon if necessary, that's the only kind of email I want to get.
How are you using the word sovereign?
I mean the Secretary of State of Massachusetts.
Why does it have to be a sovereign? Exactly.
Somebody who can pretty reliably associate a physical identity and address with an email account.
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay, there are lots of, if that's what you mean by sovereign.
So maybe a network of notary publics or, you know, something like that.
Okay.
Sure.
You know, lots of people who would be happy to.
But you can start with sovereigns because people, you know, already identify
they
themselves as a sovereign.
They should compete for that business. Maybe they're particularly good at it. Maybe people trust them more, but maybe they don't.
When I spoke earlier about the black hole list being something that we have to do now because the technology and law is collectively not good enough, this is what I mean by the technology not being good enough. If we had this, then we would not need this black hole list, and the spammers would not be able to spam. We don't have it, and it is a huge implementation cost.
And the question is, I mean, I want to just ask the question about the digital signatures. I mean, who imposes that? When you say, the solution to this is that everybody has to put a digital signature on their email. The meta question, and this is the one we've been discussing here, who decides whether people have to put a digital signature on their email? What is the process?
Each and every recipient would make the decision for themselves.
Fine. Right. There are other models. I agree. That one model is another model, of course, that there's sort of a legal requirement that you do so. There are many different models of how that might happen, and I think that's going to affect the harder.
So there is no way to enforce any kind of limit on consensual communications. If two people want to communicate, they will do that.
Although if I send an email to somebody saying, hi, I'd like to talk to you, would you like to talk to me, and I happen to be on the RBL list, there may be no easy way of reaching that person to initiate the dialogue.
But in that case, it's not that would be a non-consensual communication.
Consensual through your agent.
Right.
Your agent has...
Oh, yes, because the ISP upstream of that person
exactly.
happens
you
to have made
it.
Gotcha. Cash, you've been waiting a long time, and I assume people on that side of the room want to talk, too.
Yeah. You guys were talking earlier about a market for black hole type lists, but it seems to me like any kind of a market for a spammers list would shake out and there would ultimately be one main list. So my question is, Paul, why have you given up your dreams of being sued? Because it seems inevitable that sooner or later you're going to be sued.
Realize your dreams.
I see the shakeout coming. I am helping to precipitate it. I don't like the fact that there are a lot of different lists. I especially don't like the fact that I get occasionally blamed for the sins of others. But even without that, if somebody has a spam problem, chances are they're going to wind up on more than one list. You know, if their relay is open or whatever, then they've got the cleanup cost is not only fixing their software or upgrading or whatever, but then going around the net, finding out all the different people who have blocked, either in private lists that aren't even sort of maintained and have web pages, or in my list, the orbs list, the RSS list, and so forth. So one of the things that we are doing is opening the doors to some of the other people who maintain these lists and saying, we would like you to maintain them under the umbrella of MAPS and let us handle all of your contracts and funding and hosting and the rest of it. And so that's how we're collecting so many. We now have the real-time black hole list, the dial-up list, and the relay spam stopper, and there will be more coming. So eventually, yes, we will be probably the Internet's single provider of blocking technology, and then we might get sued again. The possibility will re-raise.
I want to question both. But predictive comments that Paul made, the normative underpinning. I don't think it's true that there will be a single provider of list, black hole list services, like so, or anti-spam services, because I think the problem is complex enough to be used about what constitutes spam.
from some commercial, non-commercial, pornographic, only pornographic stuff I want to sell. There's many dimensions upon which people will look for the services.
That's why we have more than one list, but it's all inside the same company.
And how you maintain something inside the same company, well, we can talk about that later. I don't know that that is a prediction of the future that I necessarily read. And I also don't think, I mean, it's very important to see my view of the world is that I don't think there should be a single list. I think that one of the features of this that is attractive, as I said before, is that there are multiple providers that ISPs in this case and consumer people are just to choose among to decide which is their preferred definition span and method of dealing with it. And yes, monopolization. If that's not true, I get more and more concerned about due process. If it is true, I don't care for the desktop. Collection of many different desktops, in fact, that lead to an optimal solution for the medical health.
I have one comment and one question. My comment is, as someone who receives spam and finds it extremely annoying, the real-time black hole sounds like a great thing, and I think I actually prefer a system like that that's basically private as opposed to kind of a government ban on spam, and I think there's a very strong free market effect, and the reason why so many people use your list is probably because it's very good, and if it were crappy, people would go out and get other lists or they would use more forums or whatever. And if I go to my ISP and I don't like that they're blocking the mail, then I'll either A, choose a different ISP, or I'll demand my ISP to give me the choice to opt in or out of your list. And I actually think that there's probably room for a lot of businesses, because I think ISPs, the ability to block spam is probably a very valuable service for ISPs that they would like to provide to the customers. And I would choose AOL if they had a really good spam blocking as over to someone else. And so I think it's a good thing that you're doing. And my question is kind of random, but I've always wondered, why is spam called spam?
It comes from the Monty Python sketch where you can have this with spam or that with spam, or you're in this diner from hell where everything comes with spam. So it is...
some people actually wouldn't mind that diner.
It was the canonical example of something that you can't get away from and you definitely don't want.
Hormel Foods, by the way, does have, they have a hate-love relationship with this use of spam. At first, hating it, thinking that somehow this was tarnishing their hard-won image of the canned pork shoulder product. And then later realizing that this is brand everywhere, and the use of the word just, you know, you're sitting there on the supermarket shelf, and you don't know why you picked it, but you just did. So they actually have a whole site about spam. Carmel pages. Yeah, Gavin.
If I can get you to go back, I guess, 2 points ago when you were talking about thinking that almost everybody has at least access to 5 different ISPs. One example that wouldn't fall into that would be the example of most Native American Indian tribes, where if you had, most Indian tribes tend to be rural. Most of them, at most, may have 1 to 2 ISPs available. So the act of putting them on the blocking list may have the unintended consequence of destroying email access for an entire tribe.
Contribute to the deforestation problem, everybody.
Let me just say, I have two responses to that. One is that perfection is very difficult to attain. Perfection is difficult to attain in the political process, and it's difficult to attain in a non-political process. So to the extent you have identified a problem, I think that's a valuable contribution. What that says about the process as a whole, I'm not sure. That is an empirical question, how many people are in this, what kind of values are implicated by that. The second response is the one that was just here, which is, I think, to the extent that is true, again, different debate, but to the extent that is true, I would argue that is a transition phenomenon that we should not overreact to and sort of build some sort of legal infrastructure in response, because it will be disappearing within a relatively short period of time. Reasonable people disagree about that. But
there's another very simple argument as to why that's not a problem. That is, it's quite easy to couple with your ISP provider, your email provider. In fact, I group them do that.
Right.
That way, if you relocate to another university, another company, another part of the country, another part of the planet, you can have a consistent email address. A large number of companies like Hotmail, Gmail.com, and provide email for life.
This is for Paul Dixie. It's a statement from your website that we're supposed to read for this week. It says, at our site, we reject all mail from hosts listed in the mass RBL, and some of our hosts also route all traffic destined for such hosts to a local black hole. What does that mean, the latter part that you... At our site, we reject all mail from hosts listed in the mass RBL, and some of our hosts also route all traffic destined for such hosts to a local black hole. Does that mean my mail is just being sucked up somewhere and never... What does that mean?
A local black hole is, believe it or not, a technical routing term, and it just has to do with setting up a destination which means nowhere, and then saying that other destinations should be routed through that destination to nowhere. So, it turned out we used to use the RBL in routing mode until we became unreachable by people on the list who wanted to send us mail asking to please get off the list. And so we had to turn off router mode and go into using it only inside the email server software. But there were sort of some hosts that then started using it in router mode locally rather than router mode all over the network.
What an interesting image that someone whose voice has been taken away wishes to say, wait a minute, you took my voice away and you shouldn't have, and you can't hear them because their voice has been taken away.
Yeah, what that means is there's a list, mailing list, RBL at mailabuse.org, which reaches the group of people who need to be sleuthing around trying to find out where spam came from or taking people off the list. And that mailbox cannot be protected from spam using its own technology. So we get more spam probably than anybody.
Oh, this is like a Star Trek episode. Yeah.
I want to ask Paul sort of a follow-up question on that, just to make sure that I understand. If I have a service provider and an email account. My service provider has never heard of RBL. It does not subscribe. Nothing to do with you. It has no relationship with your list. It does not subscribe. So, I think the question was, or my question is, I want to send an email to someone who, unbeknownst to me and my service provider, is on your list, at a host that is on your list. Am I correct that nothing you do interferes with that? Right? My email will get through to that person because I'm not a subscriber, et cetera. And you're talking to black hole.
Okay, so... There is no technical means by which I can prevent consensual communication between two third parties, neither of which is a subscriber to the list. However, there are other people who are in a position to do that and who do that.
Okay.
So, for example, AboveNet is a transit provider. They've got big OC12 pipes all over the world, and if two people are both buying their transit, they've got a DS3s or T1s or whatever it is, and they're using AboveNet as their network service provider, and neither one of those people is a subscriber to the list, but they can end up having their communications interfered with because AboveNet, who is their carrier, decides that their network, which they own, shall not route traffic whose source or destination is from a black hole address. So there are other people who can do that. I cannot do that and would not want to do that.
Actually, this is a totally different point, and I'm trying to distract the conversation, but the one thing I was amazed with is we haven't really talked about free speech at all in this, and we read a couple of really good articles about it in the packet, and I was curious from those who are supportive of the RVL, do you have any concerns about sort of the chilling effect on speech, my right to hear, for instance, other people's speech, the fact that it's sort of over-inclusive, under-inclusive, all sorts of things that make it seem like a sort of imprecise way to quell a kind of speech that you're trying to block, and I wonder if you could respond to that.
Careful reading of the MAPS website will reveal that sometimes we find it necessary to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and gee, that is too bad, but sometimes we find it necessary. So yes,
Supreme Court parlance, it's called burning the house to roast the pig, particularly adequate for spam.
So, yes, a good deal of legitimate email is blocked by our system. Yes, that does concern me. It sometimes it creates an onus to switch ISPs, even though you're not a spammer, you're not trying to communicate with spammers, but you're being blocked anyway because the net, the holes in the net are too small. I have gotten a lot of email from people's mothers who cannot send mail to their kids at school because of the black hole list. I am completely sad about that. And this was the lesser evil.
That's a very good question. It's not a very terribly good answer. I think the question, though, is, again, which of the two processes necessarily protect free speech, and who defines the contours of the free speech that is to be protected? This is a process that will define what is free speech, I mean, where the line should be drawn between stuff that needs to be thrown away not within the freedom of speech as others, and it will be defined in a way that I think is reflective of people's preferences about that. Better or worse, I don't know. Different than and worth considering to see whether or not you get the wrong answer that way.
Okay. This is sort of on the same topic, but a little bit different. Suppose that the lawsuit were actually to happen and you were to win, and was constitutional for you to maintain this list. So basically it comes out that this really is a privacy issue or something about private property that you are able to do this. And then someone else comes up with a very equally popular, maybe even more popular list that phases out some other type of marginalized speech. Can we come up with any example? How would you feel about that?
There are already uses of that. There are certainly still countries on Earth whose governments oppress their citizens, and in at least one case they are using my mail blocking architecture to do that. And I do not feel good about that, but I don't know how I could have prevented it. It's a little bit like publishing the anarchist's cookbook. You know, just because you don't publish it doesn't mean that people don't know how to mix the chemicals.
And again, without the supermarket. Just with reference, not too much of the book of reference, but to the extent that the speech is marginalized by virtue of intentional decision making, some speech, the lines are being drawn. The question is who gets to draw those lines to decide what is to be marginalized and what is not.
I was just going to remark that it seems to me that the level of principle what we have here is at least in some respects a struggle between First and Fourth Amendment protections. If you look at the rise of modern communications technology over the last 75 years, every time there's been a confrontation between commercial speech and privacy, privacy's lost. And one of the more insidious reasons why the court has sustained this has been the argument that that advertised commercial broadcast speech is the greater good because it makes valuable content accessible to all the populace without regard to their economic status. So, you know, my view of the RBL is that it's an empowerment of people, of the citizenry, rising up to insist on protection of their domicile in cyberspace from unwanted intrusion. And I think that, you know, to the extent that there's a very general feeling of what Paul is doing is a right thing, it's traceable back to that sort of reaction.
So we're starting to run low on time. For a final quick question, Victoria?
Now we are webcasting this class to a group of students in Argentina, and one of them has the following question. Why is the spam debate placed in the field of freedom of expression and not in the field of discrimination?
Why is this in the field of free expression and not in the field of discrimination?
Might be related to Mike's point that the First and the Fourth Amendment is the First and the 14th has. It depends on one's view of what the Constitution means. I think the First Amendment and the notion of discrimination are, in fact, very closely related to one another. This isn't a discussion about discrimination. Paul is discriminating against people who do certain things. You don't let them in his network, his subscribers' network. That has consequences for their ability to express themselves freely, as it were. Related, like the private club issue. Can you get join the gay cities where you can make your business contact, perhaps? That's a discrimination issue with the person, that's an issue. Issue. I think there's only one amendment to the Constitution anyway. I do. I mean, there really is one.
A quartering one. What about quartering of soldiers?
Exactly. No, I mean, I think they all are expressing really a less safe principle. I don't know that it matters whether you're quartering soldiers or not. I mean, it's
the way that we analyze. So, when we ended the class that integrated intellectual property and speech, the one where we talked about Marshby, Alabama so much, the final slide we had up on the screen was one that was trying to get at what does the town that is the internet look like? It's clearly a set of mostly private nodes, and the links between them are private networks, not held primarily by one entity, series of private networks, but private networks nonetheless. And one hypothesis was that you could imagine the private owners of chunks of road simply refusing to let certain people send packets their way. And indeed, what we've heard about partly is a use of the real-time black hole list and other lists like it to do exactly that. And then I suppose might say that to the extent you have a parcel of space on the net and you're choosing whose road is going to build out to you, in other words, which ISP you're going to choose, how much do you ask about what carriage it permits or doesn't? And when it comes down to it, if they don't permit it on the basis of something like a list like this, is this something to celebrate, private, bottom-up, self-organizing, constrained by the market, because if he does it wrong, he only got there because he was as he was to begin with. This is Paul Vixen, not just some other person. And if he starts screwing up, somehow word will get out and he'll lose subscribers. Or is it exactly what we feared structurally is the abuse that comes from bad government? I mean, you have structures in government. What is law at least about? But due process and civil procedure and opportunity to be heard, all these rules that in turn lawyers try to abuse as much as possible and get put into the straight and narrow by vigilant judges, but a series of structures designed precisely so that it's not by good, solid people
that we are always ruled, but even when we are ruled by bad ones, there are limits on what they can do. Now this connects a little bit to our week on monopolies and path dependence. To say, to the extent that there are alternative paths available and good information, okay, you don't like one road and how it behaves, you choose another. I am far more skeptical than David of just how well that particular market functions and is likely to function in the future, even as I am less skeptical than David, and I even think than Paul, about the spineless weasels we've heard about that are called our elected representatives in Washington, who are charged day in and day out with making tough decisions about speech. What do they do? What do we pay them for? But the legislation that says you can say that, you can do this, you can't do that. And to be sure, they are cabined by a Supreme Court or other structures that say, you went too far this time, under our laws, you can't do it. And those even seem the very structures we ask of ICANN, because ICANN is controlling an instrumentality that we think is important enough, that goes beyond the technical enough, that we can't just leave it to good people doing good work. I am not, I don't think I agree with David that the real difference between ICANN and my whole list is government blessing of one and not of the other. I think that you could have had an ICANN emerge even without the Commerce Department that would have at least de facto been as powerful as the one we have now, controlling a route as unfragmented as the one we have now, and for which we would worry about accountability. So I thought it might be nice to end actually just with a quick survey, as we do when we have both the MIT and the law students present. Here are the survey questions, and I'm going to ask for a feedback memo, then we're going to eat food, and then whoever wants to leave can leave, and then we're also, those who stay will hear this presentation about privacy. So, survey question number one. To the law students, how many think, and to be sure I have introduced questioner's bias into this, I do so proudly, how many think that private boycott lists are sufficiently accountable? So among the law students, how many think they are sufficiently accountable? Please raise your hand. Okay, how many think they are not sufficiently accountable? Okay, now, next question. Among the MIT students, how many think that private boycott lists are, you've inverted the question, Ben, it's going to completely confuse everybody. This is called question typer's bias. How many think that private boycott lists are sufficiently accountable among the MIT students? How many think that they are not sufficiently accountable? How many MIT students are here? How? I don't know about this requiring attendance thing. I see. All right, and last question for everybody. How many people are happier knowing that their mail is getting filtered by Paul's real-time black hole list? How many people hope that the real-time black hole list is not filtering their mail? Wow is right. That is definitely different than what I would have expected. For my own, just to release my biases now, I don't think it's sufficiently accountable. I worry much more than David does about it, and I will happily use the real-time black hole list. So go figure. Okay, so two things to do. First, please thank all of our many guests today. Thanks to our listeners too in Argentina and elsewhere who contributed. And now with the, And with the few minutes we have left, though I do this at the risk of detaining people, and if you really do have to go, please feel free to go, and I will not shun you. You have a blank piece of paper in front of you. That's right, it's feedback memo time again. Question number one, what's your biggest thought right now? And don't worry about if it's not big enough or something, not meant to induce writer's block. What's your biggest thought? What are you feeling interested about? Question number two, what's your biggest question? What's the biggest issue you're facing right now? And if you don't know the difference between one and two, that's okay. And question number three, anything that you want to say to me or indeed to anybody directly at this moment. And I encourage you to put your name on it if you like. If you don't want to, you don't have to. And whether or not this memo can be shared. So so there's Jack Vonderhyde. He's going to do a demonstration of, what would you title your demonstration, Jack?
a Nesson and Clark interview. Okay? Overview. Overview. A Nesson and Clark overview. Interesting. Let me make it clear that at the point that starts, I am no longer responsible for what happens in the room, nor is Hal Abelson. It's a Nesson and Von der Heide production. But that will begin in approximately 5 or 7 minutes, and we're also going to have reception and food and a chance to meet all the various people that have been talking today. And an announcement of some sort from Ksenia, or a question? Oh, email for feedback. For those who are online, why don't you email it to good old ishelp, as in Internet and Society Help, all one word, at eon, E-O-N, .law.harvard.edu. And it's hopefully not on the RBL list. We can check and see. And hopefully after today, there will be no changes with respect to us to the RBL list. So thank you again very much. If you can turn your papers in at the front of the room before you go.
Those of you who are working on the project to come up with an alternative model for ICANN, please meet in the front right here.
And could the people, the MIT students who are helping on the moot court, meet us back in that far corner? Thank you.
Okay, greetings. We're ready to start the next phase here. Please feel free to continue munching and get enough provisioning to get you through the next 30 minutes. But it would be great to start taking seats again for a 20-minute demonstration about privacy. I encourage you, as SOAS finishes their solo, to sit down. If you still got feedback memos over by the tech where Ben was sitting is the place to put them. Okay, T-minus 2 minutes before we start. 2 minutes and counting.
Okay.
Okay, so
one minute, 30 seconds. Again, if you have feedback memos up by Ben at the front, would be the place to put them.
I know. I actually have a big fan, too.
Okay, 1 minute before the presentation. Again, feedback memos up at the front by Ben.
May I introduce Mr. Jack Vonderheide. I saw a presentation that he did and was impressed by it. And it's the demonstration that impresses, so I give you to him. You're all set. Go.
Charlie, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be here at Harvard this evening. I'm going to give you a little bit of background information on myself. I'm an intelligence consultant. I own a company in Chicago that advises various government agencies, banks, other financial organizations, how to gather intelligence for a variety of purposes. Some of these purposes can be identification of clients, background investigations on individuals and groups, due diligence, things of that nature. And Charlie and I were talking, and I thought that I would give you just a brief demonstration of some of the resources that exist on the internet that can give you information about individuals. Now, many times when people see this type of a demonstration, they get kind of a gut-wrenching feeling, and they say to themselves, I wonder what information is out there about me. That's the natural reaction. I thought we'd use Charlie and also Dean Clark tonight to see what kind of information we might be able to find out in 20 minutes or so about these two individuals, perhaps some of the ways that they interact, and hopefully it will be an eye-opener and might generate some questions. In the old days, when we wanted to get information about someone, the first thing that we did was we looked them up in the phone book. Let's find out where they live. And as most of you know, phone books are now automated. So what I'm going to do, my computer just went off here, and now it's back on. I thought we'd start by going to an online phone book called InfoSpace. This is InfoSpace.com for those of you who might want to try this out a little bit later. And I thought we'd start with Charlie. This is a nationwide telephone directory. And I'm simply going to enter the last name, Nesson, and the first name, Charles. And let's do Cambridge, Massachusetts as our city and state. And let's see if we can find any information in the telephone book that might be of help to us. Now we're looking through all of the various phone listings in the United States looking for Charles Nesson in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And here he is. We've got an address, 5 Hubbard Park Road, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we've also got a telephone number. Now, if we wanted to get, we could send him flowers, we could do a lot of different things. One of the things that we do whenever we conduct a background investigation on an individual is we want to find out the people that person associates with. Perhaps they might be able to give us some additional feedback on the character of the person, maybe some of their habits, things of this nature. And in this case, obviously, we know that Charlie is an impeccable character, so we won't do that. But it might be interesting to see who some of his neighbors are. So you'll notice there's an icon here, a hyperlink that says Find Neighbors. And now what the system is going to do is simply go up and down the street where Charlie lives, and it's going to give us all of his neighbors here. Charlie, you may recognize some of these names. It's found 19 different neighbors who live on the street. And again, if we were doing an in-depth background investigation, one of the things you might do is have an operative contact some of these neighbors, particularly if they're elderly people that live on the street with a lot of time on their hands. And it's a good way to gather a lot of information that we might not be able to get from public sources. I did the same kind of a check on Dean Clark, and I found out that Dean Clark lives at 114 Irving here in Cambridge. And I thought maybe we'll go a little bit deeper into Dean Clark, and instead of just finding out who his neighbors are, let's see if we can find out some information on the house itself. And to do that, I'm going to use one of my favorite internet search tools, and that tool is called Google. G-O-O-G-L-E. Now, I'll tell you that my loyalties as far as internet search tools go change on a weekly or monthly basis. I'm very fickle. I kind of go with the latest thing. Google is a tool that I'm very, very impressed with, although most people don't know about it. It's a few alumni of Stanford that have started a company out in California, and the average age of the workforce is about 23 years old. That may seem old or just about right to you, but to me that's very, very young. And this group of people has gotten a $25 million private equity infusion because they've come up with a way to change internet searching that is really revolutionary. So I'm going to ask Google to find me the Cambridge assessor. Go out into the web. You'll notice I have two options here, Google search or I'm feeling lucky. Google search will give us kind of a more comprehensive search. After you learn to trust Google, you will go with the I'm feeling lucky bar as I do. And this says, find me the number one site, the site that's really going to satisfy me the most, and just go ahead and connect me directly there. So simply typing in the words Cambridge Assessor gets us to the Cambridge Assessor's site. And we should have the option here to enter an address, and we know that Bob Clark's address is 114 Irving, I-R-V-I-N-G. So let's look it up. Let's see if we can find this property record for Dean Clark. Here he is, Robert C. Clark and Kathleen M. Clark, 114 Irving Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts. It tells us the lot is 21,458 square feet. They bought this home in January of 1979 for $142,500. Not a bad price for a home. Let's see what it's worth today. Get a little clue as to how it may have appreciated over time. The current assessed value, building $890,300, land value $673,000, total value $1.5 million. Not a bad return on Bob and Kathleen Clark's investment. Pretty good. I think that's just great. And so we're starting to build a little bit of a picture on Charlie and on Bob. Let's go back to Google and let's see if Google can give us a sense of how Charlie and Bob might get along with one another. And remember, Google is good at taking our thoughts and getting us the number one site, having to do most with what we type in. So let's just type in here Nesson and Clark. Now, there may not be a lot of websites containing the name Nesson. It's not as common a name as Clark. But there are probably several million different pages of information that contain the word Clark. But to give you an idea as to how intuitive Google is, let's just type in the names Nesson and Clark and see what we come up with. Again, we'll say, I'm feeling lucky. Find us the number one site. It looks like we have gotten into the Harvard email system here. I wonder how many people know that this is out there for public consumption. This looks like an email exchange between Charlie, Bob. Here's something that Charlie wrote. Questions are wonderful. Sorry to hear you have the flu. Perhaps engaging something fun to think about will lift your spirits. Apparently, Charlie wrote Bob some sort of memo, and Bob is responding to this, and we could go through and see that the interaction is fairly cordial. They're certainly friendly with one another, although Dean Clark says here, "Dear Charlie, we will certainly need to have a meeting to discuss this proposal. From the little I know, I couldn't support it." So we know that there's at least a little bit of disagreement on this particular issue that they were discussing. It's interesting how many organizations, both in the academic world and in the private world, have very little security on their internal email system. And oftentimes these archives or these logs of email are out there for public consumption, and the organization may not even be aware of it. I'm sure someone at Harvard knows that this is out there for public consumption. But a lot of organizations, when they discover this, they get that pit in their stomach feeling. The acid starts churning a little bit. Now, I met Charlie at the American Bankers Association convention out in Arizona last month. Charlie served as the moderator for a panel that I was on privacy. And from the feedback that I heard and my own personal feelings, he did an outstanding job. So one of the things that I wanted to do is find out a little bit more about Charlie's role as a moderator, perhaps some of the organizations that he may have worked with as a moderator, some of the feelings that those organizations may have had about the job that Charlie did for them. And I thought that a good tool to determine this would be something called Dow Jones Interactive. Dow Jones Interactive is a news archive service. It works kind of the same way as LexisNexis. I remember LexisNexis back in the 70s. It was very, very Wizard of Oz-ish having this, or Wizard of Oz-like having this LexisNexis terminal. In fact, it was a special colored terminal, red, white, and blue. It was kept in a secure area within law firms and organizations. It was horrendously expensive. And the idea that someone could enter a person's name and gather all of this background information, news clippings, was just mind-boggling. Today, this type of technology is put out for the masses, and you can subscribe to Dow Jones Interactive for a very nominal charge. They'll give you a password, which I'll go ahead and put in here. And got to use lowercase. We have to follow the proper syntax here, so we'll turn off the caps key. Password. Dow Jones is actually in partnership with Reuters in this service. And what they've done is gone out and bought all of the back issues in electronic format of the top 6,000 newspapers, magazines, and trade journals on the face of the earth. So entering a person's name will give you a very rich investigation of any type of news clipping that might be out there. So what we're going to do now is ask it to find articles that contain both the word NESN and also the word moderator. Just thinking about it here. And I'm going to ask it to go back in time, search all of the articles that it has and all of the different publications that it has access to, and let's look for articles containing the word NESN and the word moderator. So it's running through that right now. Again, 6,000 back issues. Sometimes the archives are 25 years deep. So a lot of information, and it found 63 different articles containing both the word NESN and the word moderator. And what I'm looking for is perhaps some sort of feedback, maybe a review of one of Charlie's speeches, something like that. Let's see what we get. Super Session insurance at the crossroads a hit from August 1997. Let's see what this is all about. This is from a publication called The Interpreter. The atmosphere was one of excitement when Chuck Nelson, Vice President of Education, stepped forward to kick off the board, etc. Moderator Charles Nelson, Wells Professor of the Harvard Law School, known to many from his PBS appearances, it goes on and says, Nelson wasted no time getting the panel involved in what he calls the Socratic method. Although we suspect a bit of a plan to get things moving, the panelists denied that any such tactic was used by our esteemed moderator. And it goes on basically saying that Charlie did an outstanding job, and that's the flavor that I got from going through these other 60-plus articles, with it, is that he is indeed one of the nation's premier moderators. So I've got a little bit more information on him than simply my first impression when I met him at the American Bankers Association conference. But what about Clark? It occurred to me that as dean of Harvard Law School, the most prestigious law school in the world, perhaps Dean Clark's expertise may be sought out by others. Now, he's not well known as a moderator, but it occurred to me that perhaps different organizations have sought him out as a board member. One of the ways that we can find out if Dean Clark is on any board is to go to a tool called the 10K Wizard. The 10K Wizard enables you to enter an individual's name and search through the full text of every document that has ever been filed electronically with the Securities and Exchange Commission. It cannot be displayed. Oh, how about a .com, Jack? That would help, huh? Let's see. Better? There we go. And it very simply enables us to enter an individual's name, Robert C. Clark. And we'll now search through literally millions of pages of information looking for any SEC filings that might contain the name Robert C. Clark. Taking a little while, that could be the volume of data, or it could be the site is full or whatever. Let's see, let me come up right here. Pick time. One of the challenges when you do a live demo is to think of something to say while it's doing its magic here. So we'll give it, here we go. It is a lot of information to go through. Let's see if Dean Clark sits on any board. Let's see what we come back with here. Something's coming back. That's great. Results. That means it found 13 documents filed with the SEC that mention Robert C. Clark. Let's take a look at some of them. Let me come back here. We'll pick, at this point, we'll only pick one since our response time is so slow. Let's take this one. American Lawyer Media Holdings. Let's first go through and do a quick scan here. TIAA Real Estate Account. Collins and Aikman Corporation, Household International, etc. So we can see a number of different boards that the dean sits on. We'll just pick the first one and pull it up here. This is American Lawyer Media Holdings. Here's his name. We click on his name. Let's see what it says about this individual, Robert C. Clark. See if he is indeed our name. This will take us to the point within the document that mentions his name, so we don't have to actually go through and sift through the full text of these documents ourselves. It will take us directly to the part where his name is mentioned. Yeah, of course, don't they? The ads, all the Java applets within the ads, no problem. I mean, hey, make you sit here. I think a lot of that is by design. You sound skeptical. Yes.
This one's free?
This one is free. Everything we're doing tonight is free. Oh, I'm sorry. Dow Jones is not. Dow Jones is speeded. It's not expensive, though. It costs nothing to search Dow Jones. And if you want to buy an article on an a la carte basis, it's less than $3. All right, I'm going to give this about 15 more seconds. If it doesn't work, we'll move on. The bottom line is that this is our Dean Clark, and he does sit on all of these boards. And this will simply give us a little background information on him from the SEC filing. I'm going to go ahead and stop this. But one of the things that I noticed in going through this information was that Dean Clark sits on the board of Household International, which is a Chicago company, so it caught my eye. And one of the things I thought I would do is find out how Household stock has done over the past few years, and then perhaps see if Dean Clark has profited from that activity in stock. And we can do that by going to another site called TradingDay.com. TradingDay.com. We can enter a symbol for Household International, which is HI. Now we can ask it for quotes and charts. This is a little faster. And let's ask the system to give us a 5-year chart of Household International's stock. And you can see that over the past 5 years, it's gone from very low, under 20, to up around 40, 50, et cetera. So the stock is appreciated, and it begs the question, has Dean Clark profited personally from this appreciation in Household stock? Working off this same site, we can go back and say, give us Household International insiders. Let's get a list of insiders. We have a number of different sources that will give us this public record information of insider trading. Here are the insiders for Household International. If we go down the list, we may come to, here's Robert C. Clark. It looks like he's got some activity here. Click on his name. He's a director. And here is a complete list of his insider trading activity for this particular firm. Remember, he was a director of numerous firms. Here we see July 9th of this year, 8,000 shares. You see three events on the 9th, a sale, an exercise of options, and a planned sale. Starting with three and moving up, on July 9th, Dean Clark notified the SEC that he intended to exercise 8,000 options, and he intended to use Charles Schwab as a broker. Also on July 9th, he exercised those options and purchased those 8,000 shares for $36 a share. On the same day, he sold the shares for about $46 a share. 46 minus 36 is 10. 10 times 8,000 is 80,000. Not a bad day's work. So you can see that it's very lucrative to be involved as a director of companies when you sit on the faculty of a law school. These are just some of the different resources that are available. And what I want to point out, and then I'll take some questions, is that when we talk about the world of information is this, and this is what can be done. Within this universe of what can be done is a small subsection, and this is what may be done. Everything that we've done this evening may be done. There's nothing illegal about what we've done, even though you may get that feeling that it's a little bit invasive and some of this information should be of a private nature. It is, in fact, public, and it's perfectly okay to get this information. The other part of the world, what can be done, what may not be done, is what's really frightening. There's a black market for information in this world, and it's frightening some of the things that are sold to anyone who wants to come up with the cash on the black market. Things such as personal tax returns, medical histories, lifetime earnings histories, beeper dumps, cell phone dumps, and by that I mean if you have a beeper and I call someone on the black market and give them your beeper number, I can get a listing of every page that you've gotten over the last 90 days, everything that's been entered into your beeper. Your cell phone, I can get a list of all of the calls that you've placed from your cell phone. I can do this with your home phone, your office phone, etc. Now, much of this activity is illegal. Obviously, my clients are major banks, government agencies, etc. They tend to stay away from this illegal activity, but it is kind of a frightening world, and many of these purveyors of illegal information are outside the United States, and it's consequently very difficult to monitor them. They're not subject to U.S. laws, so it's very difficult to regulate. So I just want to give you kind of a brief overview as to some of the things that are out there that exist, and with that I'd like to take any questions that anyone might have. Yes, ma'am. Well, that particular question was, why did that particular email come up and how could I get the rest of them? The particular one came up because Google, the search tool, felt that that was the one that most matched my requirements. Had I done a regular Google search as opposed to I'm feeling lucky, it would have come up with additional options for me to choose. Yes, sir. Well, that's an excellent question. It's one that I've been asked before. And how I feel, personally, I'd like to see it less easy to get, even though it would infringe upon my livelihood. I don't like the trend that's happening in the information world, and I can see a lot of different ways how the trend would adversely impact me. As an example, many municipalities are now looking at the toll tags. You have toll tags out here where you don't have to pay a toll. You simply have a barcode on your window and it reads the barcode. They're now looking at that as a method for issuing traffic citations. Take the time it takes you to get from toll booth A to toll booth B, figure that in to the rate of speed, and if you're speeding, simply mail you a ticket. I don't like going to a grocery store and having them tell me, we'll give you 10% off if you give us your private information and allow us to build a dossier on your shopping habits. So, yeah, I'd kind of like to see it slow down, but it's not going to. And I think the market is going to determine exactly what's available, and I think the trend is only going to be more information, unfortunately. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.